You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks again for joining me this week. We have a great show for you. Of course, a great guest, because that's what we do here on Blue Lives Radio. But before we even get going and we take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue, I'm going to ask you to do one thing. I'm going to ask you to go to thewoundedblue.org. That's www.thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for the organization that is the National Association for Injured and Disabled Police Officers. It is a support organization for these men and women who have given so much in the line of duty. We desperately need your help to raise money to get this movement going. And if you are a GoFundMe-er, go to GoFundMe, look up The Wounded Blue, and you can give there as well. But check it out, please, and also check out our film, The Wounded Blue, on Amazon.com. Now, let's take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. Lots to talk about this week. The first thing I want to talk about is the death of a police officer. As you know, if you listen to this show regularly, at the end of this show, we do a segment called End of Watch, where we read the names of each police officer who's been killed in that week prior, and we pay our respects to them. I did that this week as well. At the end of the show, you're going to hear the name of Trooper Gerald Ellis of the Illinois State Police. But there is something more to this story, and it's vital that you know what a hero this man has been. Trooper Gerald Ellis was killed when his troop car was struck head-on as he was getting off duty. He was headed home. He was in his troop car, and he saw a wrong-way driver coming down the interstate. He saw that there were people behind him, and this trooper committed probably one of the most selfless acts I can even imagine. He knew that he was facing mortal danger when he aimed his patrol car and struck that wrong way vehicle head on. He sacrificed his life so that others may live. Now, Trooper Ellis was the second Illinois trooper to be killed this week in traffic collisions. But this was more than a traffic collision. This was an act of incredible heroism. It is absolutely shocking to me that the American media has not even acknowledged this man's sacrifice, this trooper's sacrifice. But we certainly will hear on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. If there was a Medal of Honor similar to what is in the military for law enforcement officers on a national basis, and there should be, this trooper would get it. He quite literally sacrificed his life, knowing he was going to face that mortal danger when he aimed his patrol car at that missile that was coming down the road the wrong way. So to Trooper Ellis' family, I say that Trooper Gerald Ellis died a hero, and he's deserving of this nation's honor and accolades. And I know that won't bring him back, but he is a hero. There's a lot more going on in law enforcement, as there usually is. And as you well know, I'm not shy about talking about it. So let's talk about some other things happening in law enforcement or surrounding it. I do not like to get political I personally am not affiliated with a political party. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent. And I have always abhorred the politics that goes along with party lines. That being said, what is taking place, or what took place in a presidential, a Democratic presidential candidate endeavor, if you will. I don't even know what to call it. But there was a group of Democratic individuals from that party that had a gathering to look for and support the Democratic Party. And in what I can only describe as some of the most disgusting rhetoric and honor that I can imagine, is that they featured a cop killer as an individual that they relegated as a leader of their movement. Her name is Joanne Chesmard. She killed a trooper in New Jersey many years ago, executed him with his own weapon, and then escaped from prison because the morons in New Jersey sent her to a minimum security prison, where she just promptly walked away. She's been living in Cuba all these years, and now she has become a darling of the left. And apparently the Democratic Party is part of that. And they are basically hailing her as a hero and a leader of Democratic Party. And the fact that they have elevated her to this status, I find absolutely abhorrent and disgusting. They treat her like a hero. They treat her like she is contributed something to society, when in fact she is a murdering piece of human garbage. The fact that they hail her as a hero, I think, is a shows the reality of what certain people think about this political process. I'm disgusted about it. As I said, I try to stay away from political commentary as it goes towards different political parties, but this is something I cannot ignore. The fact that they are honoring her as a hero is, to me, reveals something, that there is something very, very wrong in politics today. Let's move on. The Pittsburgh mayor wants to make currently justified law enforcement shootings illegal. Now, this guy, this Pittsburgh mayor, his name is Bill Peduto. He is referring to a law enforcement shooting that took place, where the law enforcement officer, as an East Pittsburgh cop, it was his first day on the job, responded to a attempted murder, spotted the suspect vehicle with three suspects in it. The vehicle stopped. Two of the individuals ran. He chased one of them. He believed that he had a gun in his hand. He was a suspect in an attempted murder with a weapon. He opened fire when the suspect did not heed his warnings to stop, and he killed him. Now, the officer was white, suspect was black, he was 17 years old. This was once again painted as a racially motivated shooting. This police officer was vilified by the entire political structure in the Pittsburgh area, but the jury found him not guilty in just hours. And the reason they found him not guilty is because, unfortunately for the political narrative, a police officer doesn't have to feel that there is an imminent threat to himself. That is, somebody pointing a gun at him, although in this particular case, the officer believed that he had pointed a gun at him. All a law enforcement officer has to do with a fleeing felon, someone who's committed a violent felony, is articulate why that individual is a threat to others, not just to himself. And the reality is that overcharging him, charging him with murder, was a political move, not one that was designed to get justice. It was designed to shore up the political careers of the district attorney. And this mayor, who didn't have anything to do with it, came out and is so angered at the fact that the justice system actually worked the way it's supposed to in finding this officer not guilty, wants to change the law similar to what's the movement that is taking place in California today, where legally justified shootings are changed through statute in such a way that the officers can be charged criminally with murder or other offenses. This is what's going on politically around the country, that political figures, district attorneys, state's attorneys, prosecutors, are basically using law enforcement as their personal punching bag. It's their political punching bag. And appealing to their base of voters who are anti-law enforcement by ruining the lives of these officers who are involved in officer-involved shootings. You know, a law enforcement officer has literally sometimes split seconds to make a life and death decision. Many of these officers are not trained properly, and yet when they act in accordance with the training that they do get, there are factions in this country, political factions, as the mayor of this city, Pittsburgh, who absolutely couldn't care less about the justice of this. They're looking for political points, and they're willing to literally sacrifice the lives of cops to do it. This individual, who's the mayor, doesn't even have any political say here. It wasn't his city. He was in a neighboring community. And yet, he is calling for laws to be changed so that justifiable shootings can result in police officers being prosecuted and imprisoned. This is what's going on in a number of different areas. Pennsylvania, I didn't really expect it. California, yeah, I do expect it, and I've seen it happening. But I certainly do not expect it to happen in Pennsylvania. It shows you how widespread these new activist politicians are and how far they're willing to go in order to feather their own political nests, if you will. Now, in a court ruling that took place, you know, it seems like judges mostly have common sense when it comes down to how they adjudicate these cases involving law enforcement. Another situation that arose out of Lawrence, Kansas. Now, this is a kind of a bizarre situation, but when I fill you in, I think you'll understand what I'm talking about. Here's the headline: Judge tosses charges against ex-cop who shot suspect attacking fellow officer. Let me give you the background on this, because it's really important that you know the story involved here. So, a Lawrence, Kansas police officer had made a traffic stop on a minor violation. And by the way, all of this is captured on dash cam and video cam, body cam. So this officer makes a car stop. It is you know, when you hear the word routine traffic stop, even though there truly are no routine traffic stops, this is what it would be referred to as simply a traffic violation for a minor offense. Well, the driver immediately is confrontational with the officer. Won't cooperate, won't give the license or registration. Argumentative and just clearly will not cooperate. The officer calls for a backup. He sees that this situation is going south, and he does what he's supposed to do. He calls for assistance. Well, by the time the second officer got there, a female officer, he was in a fight with this guy. The guy had gotten out of the car. The officer tried to place him under arrest, and the fight was on. And they're rolling around the street. It's a knockdown, drag-out fight. This female officer gets to the scene. Now, she's a brand spanking new officer. She's got very, very limited street experience. She attempts, in her mind, she believes that she should utilize her taser on the combative suspect. And she attempts to do that. However, she mistakes her service weapon for her taser. Yeah, you can see where this is going, right? So thinking she's tasing him, she shoots the suspect. She doesn't kill him, but she sure as hell shoots him. And you can hear on the tape, she goes, "Oh my God, I shot him." What in reality happened was she was not up to the task. She hadn't been either trained appropriately, or she had not gotten the experience and the warrior spirit enough to understand and utilize the proper amount of force. And so she mistook her firearm for her taser and shot this combative suspect. Now, listen, I'm not feeling sorry for this guy, really. He was injured, wasn't killed. It was his actions that precipitated the moment. But when it comes down to it, the police are just going to have to write that check, right? Just write the check. Shut up and sign on the bottom line. But a district attorney in Lawrence, Kansas, decided they were going to arrest this police officer for aggravated assault, put her in prison. This is the kind of insanity that I talk about when I refer to activist prosecutors. They are so bent on making a headline and showing the community that they are they're justice, social justice oriented, that they took this mistake that this female officer made, and instead of punishing her in the way that it is prescribed here as a civil punishment, they want to go after her and put her in prison. It's insane. So they charge her. She goes before the judge, and the judge has a great deal of common sense and says this is not appropriate. This is not something that should be done. And so luckily, she got before a judge that had the common sense and the courage to do the right thing. And so he immediately dismissed the charges. And that's that. Now, what happens to her? Well, first of all, she got fired immediately. I think that's probably appropriate. The other thing is that this is why civil judgments exist. It is for situations like this where police negligence or training issues are to be evaluated and then dealt with appropriately, but certainly not a criminal charge. Unfortunately, this is the trend in America, and it's interesting that juries and judges are almost universally dismissing these frivolous charges against these law enforcement officers because they are, seeing the facts and dealing with them not from a political point of view, but from a common sense point of view. And when you see these prosecutors who are out there making political statements based on these criminal prosecutions, it's pretty transparent what their motives are, and it certainly isn't justice. Now, once again, let's talk about another judge's decision, and this one's in California. I was really happy to see this. Now, here's the headline: Judge strikes down California's high capacity ammo ban. Now, this is something that has far-reaching effects. California, of course, loves to lead the nation in stupid laws. And so, in the usual knee-jerk reaction of the politicians in California, if they had their way, they would ban all guns. Well, they can't, but they're trying to backdoor the Second Amendment. And so what they did was they claimed, or they passed a law that said any magazine for a semi-automatic weapon that holds more than 10 rounds is now, they waved like a magic wand and said, this is now illegal. And what that does in essence is it takes hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions, of legal gun owners and makes them criminals because they have high capacity or magazines that have more than 10 rounds. Well, almost every semi-automatic pistol and rifle manufactured today has more than that. So what they did was they made up an arbitrary number and then they made it illegal. And they actually wanted law enforcement, of course, let's leave it to the law enforcement guys, to then, arrest people, confiscate these magazines, put good people in prison because of their anti-gun mania. Well, guess what? A federal judge in San Diego ruled that the state law banning magazines of more than 10 rounds was unconstitutional. And this judge did not mince any words. District Court Judge Roger Benitez, he ruled that the California law violated the Second Amendment rights of gun owners and issued an injunction barring state officials from enforcing it. And in essence, what he said was, you can't interfere with a person's right to defend themselves because of your arbitrary and capricious thoughts about gun control. Now, you know what the reaction has been from the California politicians. They're losing their collective minds. The governor, Governor Newsom, he's probably pulling his hair out because things didn't go his way. Just as the other political activist elected officials, they're now licking their wounds, so to speak, and they're vowing to take this to a higher court. And I certainly hope that they do, because there's no doubt in my mind that this is a federal appellate court. I think the next level of court is the Supreme Court. And I would love to see the Supreme Court make a ruling on this case and these states that are arbitrarily banning magazines and making criminals out of good citizens need to have their hinies slapped, if you will, because what they're doing is actually unconstitutional, against the law, and this judge gave them a little bit of their own medicine. That's about it for today in the briefing room, where I give you My View from the Blue. Now we're going to take a walk into the interview room. I want to tell you about a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. If you are an active duty law enforcement officer and you're looking to work extra jobs like security and traffic jobs, these are the people you need to go through. We all know that working extra jobs is what gives us the extras, gives us that little extra payment that we need, or perhaps gives us the opportunity to take our families out to dinner a little more often. And the only way to do it is to be working extra jobs. So what they do is they're all over America. I think they're in everything but a couple of states. And they work with your organization, your administration, and find off-duty jobs to work. You got to check them out. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com and register with them, contact them. Now, if you have security needs, this is the company you want to go through as well. If you are looking for both security or traffic jobs, if you have a company that requires that, you want to contact these folks as well. They're good people. They're based in Arizona, but they have police officers and services all over the country. Go to offdutypoliceofficers.com. I want to tell you guys about a pretty amazing product. It's called Arrest My Vest Spray. And really what it's designed to do is when you are wearing a ballistic vest, you know, it gets sweaty, it gets hot, it gets drenched, you know, from working out in the street. And sometimes it doesn't smell all that well. And this is an amazing product that takes that odor away. And you don't even have to use it just for the vest. It takes pet odors away. It's great for your vest. It's great for your dog bed. Everything else that that you need a deodorizer for, this stuff is amazing. Check it out. It's at stinkyvest.com. Go to stinkyvest.com and check out Arrest My Vest Spray and arrest the odors.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is John Shanks. John is the National Director of the Council for a Strong America's Police Training Institute. Now, John started his career in law enforcement in the United States Air Force as a law enforcement specialist. He retired from the Air Force as a course manager for advanced law enforcement training at the Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. He then attended the Texas State Police Academy, and he did that while he was on active duty with the Air Force. And then he started his civilian law enforcement career while serving in the Air Force. After leaving Texas, he moved to D.C., worked as a lobbyist on Capitol Hill on law enforcement issues. And then he worked as the director of law enforcement relations at the National Law Enforcement Officer Memorial Fund and helped to build the National Law Enforcement Museum. And now he is the national director of the Police Training Institute and has led their efforts to develop and deliver a very special program that I really want to talk about. And it's about connecting youth and communities with law enforcement. John, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Hey, Randy, thanks for having me. It's really great to be here.
You know, you've got a long career in the law enforcement area. I mean, everything from your service in the Air Force, which was law enforcement related, then you left the Air Force, retired, became a civilian police officer, and you've been involved in training aspects for basically your entire career. So let's talk about what's going on in law enforcement today. You know, we are seeing an emphasis on, shall we say, a softer policing as opposed to what we used to see as far as officer survival and tactics and things like that. And while, of course, I understand that there needs to be a well-rounded program, with the number of law enforcement deaths and assaults, how do we, as a profession, how does law enforcement start changing the paradigm and making officers safer?
Yeah, and that's really important that we address that. And I think any training component must first really look at officer safety, right? And anything we do, anything we talk about, and there's a lot of stuff out there in the world today, but really needs to focus officer safety first. And that's one of the things we do, is really say, okay, all of this is good stuff. We're gonna talk about how to connect youth and communities with law enforcement, how officers can interact with youth on the street, at 3 o'clock in the morning. Do you have the resources to have a good, positive interaction? But we also realize right up front that, officer safety is first. The safety of the citizens around us is also paramount. So how do we have an encounter where, and our motto, everyone goes home? Because the reality is, that's where we want to be, right? End of the day, we want to go home to our families. Parents want their kids home in their beds at night or at the dinner table. So we really have to focus on how do we train and give not only law enforcement, but the community the tools they need to have positive interactions, and the end result, everyone goes home.
No, I like that. I like the that's a great phrase. Everyone goes home, and that includes even the bad guys. The public often gets a misrepresentation about how law enforcement deals with deadly force and use of force situations. Very often, the media, of course, is plays it up so that it makes it appear that law enforcement officers are out there running and gunning, trying to, be these trigger-happy individuals who don't care about the ramifications of deadly force, when in fact, just the opposite is the truth. And when a police officer is forced to take a life, forced to use deadly force, it has a dramatic effect on them psychologically, emotionally, even physically. So the idea of everyone goes home is, I think, a very, very strong training mantra, if you will. So the company that you work for, they deliver police training. How do they do that? I mean, in what form?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. We're actually, technically we're a company, but we're a national nonprofit. So as a 501c3 nonprofit organization, our parent organization, Council for a Strong America, who believes that if we invest in youth early in life, that they don't become a customer of law enforcement later in life, or that they have the opportunity to be successful people in life. One of our mottos on the Council for Strong America is strong nation. We want to build a strong nation so that young people will grow up not with a criminal record, not having negative interactions with law enforcement, but have the ability to join the military and serve to protect the country if that's what they want to do, to become successful in business if they want to, or in sports. So, really it's how do we as adults help achieve that goal of giving our young people the tools they need to be able to achieve that. Now, within that, there is Fight Crime Investing Kids, is a group of over 5,000 police chiefs, sheriffs, and prosecutors, and their tagline is, "I'm the guy you pay later." Well, you know what? We don't want to pay them later. We want to create an environment where the kids aren't going to jail. Something you said early on, and as we started this, was you know, there are people, we all realize, right, there are people who are going to go to jail. So our goal is not not to take anybody to jail, but our goal is to provide law enforcement with tools that they can draw upon, because sometimes jail is not always the option, but maybe it's the only option the officer thinks he or she has out on the street. So we want to provide tools that the officers can draw upon. So our fight crime members came to us and said, you know, hey, we need help with our officers, kind of giving them some tools that they can use to have better interactions with youth. You know, a few years, over the last several years, there's been a lot of media outcry, a lot of media scrutiny of law enforcement, and the chiefs and sheriffs are like, man, they're beating us up. We need to stop this. Fortunate to say, we're not seeing a lot of that right now, but we are, and anybody who's ever served knows that we're under a microscope, right? So what can we do to have better interactions, positive interactions, emphasize officer safety, and at the end of the day, everybody goes home? So myself and my team got together and created Connecting Youth and Communities with Law Enforcement. There's four core areas that I'd like to just mention briefly that really brings it home. And two, I want to emphasize. When I started, and I've been in policing now for over 41 years, I started in 1978. In 1978, kids were kids, and they were either good kids or bad kids, right? A lot has changed since then. And one of the topics that we delved into is adolescent brain development. When I talk about adolescent brain development, anybody who's ever been a parent or had any interaction with kids, they know this all too well. You see the mom yelling at her teenager in the mall, and she says, son, you know what you just did was wrong. And he says, uh-huh. And she says, and you know there's a consequence, right? And he goes, uh-huh. Why'd you do it? Well, I don't know. Well, you know what the truth is? They don't. They really don't know why they did, even though they have all of the information to make a good decision. They don't make good decisions. That's important. If you really think about policing and everything that we have to take into account when we're on the street, whether it's at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 3:30 in the morning, when you look at a young person who's just done something really stupid, taking into account, now crime is crime, and there are, as I said, there are people who are going to be arrested, are going to have to go to jail, or going to have to, you know, have their parents, but just having that knowledge that, hey, this may be adolescent brain development. This may be a kid who just doesn't get it, doesn't understand. So being able to take that into consideration. The other area that I really want to emphasize, too, that I think helps police. When I started, again, 1978, just a few years after the Vietnam War, if I say PTSD, everybody in the audience immediately thinks about the veterans coming back from Vietnam, coming back from Desert Storm, Desert Shield, and the war on terrorism. But the reality is our young people deal with PTSD too. So, you know, when I was coming up through the ranks, hey, there's crazy people out there. You're going to need to learn to deal with them. They didn't tell us anything about that. They didn't teach us about PTSD, why it's there, what causes it, and how people react to it. So we try to give the officers some information about PTSD, specifically in youth. You know, a kid who lives in a neighborhood where there's a drive-by every night and sleeps under his bed instead of on his bed because it's a safer place, that's a form of PTSD if they live in a violent neighborhood. But again, officers just need to have a working knowledge of that, right? And understand that there are other things that take into consideration when they're interacting with young people. So, you know, implicit bias and explicit bias, we go into that in detail, as well as de-escalation. That's stuff we've all been learning for many, many years. But, you know, having those communication skills, having those tools to be able to evaluate, and that's, you know, so much of what we do in law enforcement is evaluating a situation, and having these extra resources tucked away in our head to be able to evaluate a situation, bad kid, bad crime, got to go to jail, that's going to happen. Maybe there's something else here. And maybe instead of just locking this kid up, maybe we can help him and get him in the right place so that they can be a successful citizen. So Cycle is all about bringing youth and communities together. And it really is about, we do a lot of work before we come to a community. We do listening sessions with the kids in a town hall meeting, and go out on ride-alongs with the officers so we learn that community and are able to provide a high-quality training with as much knowledge as possible to make it important, relevant, and current.
That's an interesting training concept. I mean, I really haven't heard that being used a lot, because generally speaking, the normal training concept is a police agency will have their internal training component, and then they'll bring in outside trainers for particular topics. But usually it's simply the classroom setting where it's audiovisual, it's lecture, and it's basically information that's being given to the officers. What you're saying here is that before you bring this training actually to the officers themselves, you're doing a whole variety of work within the community prior to that training. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah, Randy, that's exactly what you're understanding. Let me explain why that's important, because when we came on board, that was a big part of the program was, for me, one, we have to interact both with the community and law enforcement. It's not just law enforcement's responsibility for all the woes in the community. So I want to say this is important. I've been an officer, a rank and file officer, sitting in a classroom, and a guy walks in and says, "Hi, I'm from Washington, D.C., and I'm here to tell you how to do your job." Right? Nobody wants that. That's the last thing anybody wants to experience. We did not want that to be a part of this program. So in order to not have that happen, right, we come in, we meet with community leaders, we meet with schools, we meet with youth. We have private listening sessions where youth can tell us what they think, feel about law enforcement. We learn that. We go on, we visit the police academy. We talk to the trainers. We talk to the command staff. We go on ride-alongs and watch how law enforcement officers interact with you. So we have that firsthand knowledge. When my team steps into a classroom to talk about, we're there to talk about that community and how that community can and thrive and build that bridge to be able to interact. Somebody wants to talk about Baltimore or Boston or New York City, we say, I appreciate that, but that's not why we're here. We're here to talk about this community and really interact with the youth. What another component of our program that isn't happening is that we provide an engagement, we call it youth engagement, but it's a training session, a one full day of training with youth in the community where they learn about their own bias. A lot of kids can tell you bias. Oh, yeah, I know bias. It's like, really? Let's talk about it. Do you really? No, they don't. So we talk to them about bias. We talk to them about self-de-escalation, because we find that kids can be powerful leaders in their neighborhood. And imagine how safer it becomes for law enforcement when a young person de-escalates a situation before the first patrol car arrives on scene.
That's a really interesting concept. This is not something that that you'll hear, I don't think, from the politicians. Politicians want to talk about de-escalation only being part of the law enforcement responsibilities. What you're saying here is that you're looking at kind of changing the paradigm and putting the de-escalation responsibility not just on the police, but empowering this information to youth so that they can make decisions that are rational and de-escalate and actually be part of the solution. I think that's really a tremendous concept. How are you finding that I guess you're talking about young people. What ages are you talking about, and how are you seeing their reaction to this?
Well, so the ages, we average 13 to 14 years up through 24, all right? Because when you look at the adolescent brain development, you know, our brains don't mature until we're 25, 26 years of age. We start at 13, 14 years old because we want young people who are actually, you know, out and about and starting to be independent and having interactions with law enforcement. So it's that teen through early 20s age is where we focus. And we really want them to come in and share their experiences. But let me tell you, our program, we're funded through grants from foundations. We did a process and outcome evaluation. Our outcome evaluation, which just finished up, was done by a third-party independent research firm who went out and did focus groups and interviews with both police officers and youth who'd been through our program. The end result was that the program had same amount of interactions between police and youth. That didn't change. Cops and kids, you know, youth are going to interact. They're going to talk. There's going to be calls for service. What changed was the amount of use of force between law enforcement and youth, and the amount of arrests between police and youth. And the reason for that is, I believe, is one, we're working with both the youth and law enforcement. We're giving law enforcement tools to make great decisions and have positive interactions. But the kids, we had a quote just 2 weeks ago. We were in Albuquerque, New Mexico, training, and one of the youth said at the end, "I came into this morning hating the police. I now totally understand they're people too, and they're really out there trying to do the right thing for us. I have a totally different opinion of the police."
You know, that's fascinating, and I think that this is something that we have seen without the same formalities, that when people open their minds and actually interact, when a police officer actually has an interaction with a citizen that they may have never had an interaction, a true interaction before, that they get to see each other as human beings. And you know, very often law enforcement officers are seen by people in the community as an automaton, as a uniform, and not as a human being. And much of that I have to blame on the media, who has dehumanized law enforcement, and also on politicians who have dehumanized law enforcement officers and portrayed them as something less than a human being. So the fact that you are, I guess, in essence, creating a safe environment where this less formal interaction can take place, and that allows almost a relationship of some sort to be developed, which takes the fear away about about law enforcement officers.
Yeah, and so one of the things too, and I just to follow up on that, we don't train the cops and the kids apart from each other. We start off with them apart, but what we do is we bring them together at the end of the training, and they share a meal, and we have the officers share with the youth what their job was before they became a police officer, and which is an eye-opener for any of us. We all know what we did before we became cops, and it wasn't always, you know, it might have been McDonald's or Burger King or mowing lawns, whatever, but we all had a life before law enforcement, so we humanized law enforcement. But we also then we do some role plays, right? We want the kids to practice what they've learned. We want the officers to practice what they've learned. And we bring them together. But what's really fun and fascinating is if you want to create empathy and understanding, between these two groups. We start off with traditional roles, cops being cops, kids being kids. We set up a scenario, the cops show up, they take care of scenario. Three or four scenarios in, we say, okay, now you, which kid, you know, who wants to be an officer? So we let a kid be an officer, partnering up with another officer, and then an officer and a kid be the people they're coming to respond to. We run that through. By the end of our role-playing scenarios, the kids are the cops and the cops are the kids. This is really exciting because what we see is we ask the kids, stand, talk, walk, do everything like the officers do when they arrive in your neighborhood. Officers, stand, talk, walk, look exactly like the kids do when you arrive in their neighborhood. And they get to see each other through each other's eyes.
That's got to be
And
some,
it's really
that's
amazing
gotta be
to watch
pretty
the
funny
young people.
Stuff too.
Oh, it's amazingly funny, but it's also amazingly enlightening for the youth to see how cops portray them and for the cops to see how the youth portray the officers. And it just creates this empathy and understanding. We love seeing the kids who put both hands up on their collar and hold it up there. And we're like, why are your hands up by your neck? And they're like, I don't know. That's the way cops stand. Do you know why they're standing that way? They're trying to get some air underneath that vest, you know, and it's hot. And they're like, all of a sudden, they're like, oh, wow, that makes perfect sense, right? And so it's a lot of fun, but it's at the end of the day, I mean, the cops and the young people are sharing, interacting. They have an understanding. We had one young man, and Randy, this was just amazing. He had a really horrible experience with law enforcement, and I'm not going to go into the details. But by the end of his experience, he was talking with some sheriff's deputies, and all he wanted to know was, how do I become a sheriff's deputy?
That's a success in and of itself. When you're changing those minds at that young age, and revealing the positives about law enforcement to them, and they're absorbing it. I mean, that's got to be very satisfying to you personally, as you've created much of this training. For you to see this has got to be personally a great deal of self satisfaction.
Yeah, it's amazing. Thank you. On the other side, too, I also have to say we get feedback from the officers, weeks after the training. Hey, I had a call last night, and because of your training, I was able to listen and understand, and where this young lady who I might typically have just locked up and thrown the key away because I wouldn't have anything else to do with her, is I was able to listen and let her know that what she was experiencing is normal, and be able to get her, push her in the right direction, find out that she's really not the problem, that there was something else causing the problem in her world. So we do a lot of that stuff, and it's good. It's very rewarding.
That's fantastic. So now, how do law enforcement, are you hired by law enforcement agencies itself, or do communities bring you in? How does that work?
So we partner with law enforcement agencies. We first off, our training is free of charge. We're funded through grants. So if an agency would like to learn more about the cycle training program or bring it into their community, they can reach out to me, and I'd be happy to talk to them about that. We are, we come in. We first meet with the law enforcement agency. We ask them to host us. We also partner with some community groups, and we come in and do our work beforehand, and we do the training. We want it to be very low level of heavy lifting on the police department's part. We want to make this easy for them, but get the maximum impact from the training for their officers.
Is there a website that they can look at and get information?
Sure. So they can go to www.strongnation.org, and then / all capital letters PTI, Police Training Institute. So strongnation.org/PTI, and they can reach out And if it's okay, I'll give my email address. They can reach out to me directly.
And your email address is jshanks@fightcrime.org.
Yes, sir.
So we're running out of time, John. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on to the show and to talk about this amazing training program that you've got. It's really designed to change thinking patterns and to change the way people view the police, at the same time changing the way police may view the community. Very innovative and great stuff. So thanks again for what you do, and thanks for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Thanks, Randy.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to the men and women who have given their lives in the line of duty and made the ultimate sacrifice. This week, I have two names to read. The first is Trooper Brooke Jones Story of the Illinois State Police. Trooper Brooke Jones Story was struck and killed by a tractor trailer while conducting a traffic stop on U.S. Route 20 near State Route 75 in Freeport. She had stopped another tractor trailer and was conducting an inspection of it when another truck ran off the road, striking her patrol car before striking her and the truck she was inspecting. The driver of that truck that struck her was charged with several traffic citations. Trooper Jones Story had served with the Illinois State Police for 12 years and was assigned to District 16. She is survived by her husband. Trooper Brooke Jones Story, Illinois State Police. End of Watch, Thursday, March 28th, 2019. And incredibly, the next officer that I read is also from the Illinois State Police, who was killed just days later. Trooper Gerald Ellis of the Illinois State Police. Trooper Gerald Ellis was killed in a vehicle collision while on patrol. He was on patrol traveling westbound on I-94 in Green Oaks when a wrong-way driver traveling eastbound in the westbound lanes struck the trooper head-on. Trooper Ellis was taken to Advocate Condell Medical Center, where he died from his injuries. He had served with the Illinois State Police for 11 years and was assigned to District 15. Trooper Gerald Ellis, Illinois State Police. End of Watch, Saturday, March 30th, 2019. May they rest in peace. Thanks so much for tuning in again this week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Couple things. First of all, follow me on Facebook, the voice of American law enforcement. That's what Facebook's under. Also, follow my Wounded Blue page. It's The Wounded Blue, and that's also on Facebook. If you are a Twitterer, at LT Randy Sutton, and also check out my new television show. That's right. It's on an app called OpsLens, OpsLens. Download that app and watch True Blue, the voice of American law enforcement. I'll see you again next week. Thanks for tuning in.